From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Telly Sherritt's new book is not a manual for getting people to change their minds and agree with you. Not really. But she does want it to be useful. Sherritt is a neuroscientist, and the book is about the nature of influence, how the mind and the brain operate. She explores how information or emotion shapes our opinions. It's more emotion than fact, by the way. And here's more. People are motivated by fear. They want control. Immediate rewards work better than threats at getting people to act. And look, if you wanted to use some of Sherritt's insights to get your brother-in-law to change his mind about the election at dinner on Thursday, who's going to stop you? Just how much power do we have to change a person? Join us after the news.
Support for this Radio West podcast comes from Primary Children's Hospital. They've been recognized by U.S. News and World Reports for care in all 10 pediatric specialties, including cardiology, orthopedics, neurology, and cancer treatment. Primary Children's Hospital, the child first and always.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. All right, here's the scenario. You're with the in-laws at Thanksgiving dinner, and your father-in-law, who's a great guy, also happens to be a climate change denier. He listens to talk radio. He watches a lot of Fox News. He knows the talking points, but let's be honest, he doesn't have a clue about the science. So you have come ready. You've got articles and graphs. You've honed your argument. And you figure sometime after dinner, right before the pie, you are going to wade in. Well, Telly Sherritt knows what's going to happen. She's a neuroscientist who studies human behavior. And what she would tell you about this epic argument you have in mind is, don't even try. You're not going to change his mind because the data doesn't matter. Well, it matters, of course, in the bigger scheme of things, but it doesn't matter to your father-in-law. In a new book, Sherritt explains how your father-in-law is motivated, how you are motivated, more by desire than logic, more by hope than reason, more by fear than peer-reviewed consensus. Sherritt is an associate professor of cognitive neuroscience at University College London. Her book is called The Influential Mind, What the Brain Reveals About Our Power to Change Others. She joined us from a studio on the campus of the Massachusetts Institute of Technology in Boston. You've been spending your career conducting these experiments, trying to figure out what causes people to change their decisions. I wondered, what is it that interests you about that? Like, what interests you about, and this is a pretty broad question, but, you know, about human behavior, firstly.
Ooh, well, I think that's actually an easy question. I mean, human behavior is just fascinating, isn't it? I think it's probably fascinating for everyone because it's understanding ourselves and understanding everyone that we interact with. So if you're interested in, you know, your world, you're going to be interested in human behavior. So that was always something that fascinates me. And if you want to understand human behavior, well, then you really need to understand the brain. Yeah. Because every thought that we have, every emotion that we have, every decision that we make is a consequence of what's going on in our brain.
You, as you say in the book, our brains are not fully ours, that we're the product of this ancient code. Say something about that.
Well, I think we all have a sense that we're quite unique. And the truth is that a lot of our behavior and a lot of our thoughts and a lot of our feelings are, of course, not unique. You know, they're shared by all other humans. And this is partially because we are products of our genetics. And what I always find interesting is that when I conduct experiments in the lab, I can actually predict the behavior of individuals. At least 80% of people's responses, their decisions can be predicted by the average response. And the individual differences, they're there, but they're not as overwhelming as the kind of rules that guide us. So I think it's natural that when we think about ourselves and we think about the people around us, what we focus on is we focus on our differences, right? Yeah. But in fact, there's much more commonalities than differences.
You tell the story that reveals your own, I guess, despite knowing what you know, studying what you study, your own kind of vulnerability about all of this. And you tell this story Hearing Donald Trump talking about vaccines, which I think is a good illustrator of how irrational, I guess, how emotional we can be. Tell the story, if you would.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I begin the book with this story. And it really demonstrates the power of emotions and how it affects our thinking and sometimes our decisions as well. So I was watching the debate between Donald Trump and Ben Carson. And at the time, my younger son was 8 weeks old and he was next to me on the sofa. And the debate turned from, you know, taxes and immigration to vaccines. And Donald Trump has been known to say that there's a link between childhood vaccines and autism. Now, Ben Carson is a pediatric surgeon, and he was asked, well, what do you think about what Trump is saying? And so Dr. Carson said, well, look, there's all of this data and all of these studies and evidence showing that there isn't actually a link between childhood vaccines and autism. And he said something along the lines of, Donald Trump is an intelligent person, and I think, i.e. Ben Carson said that if he looks at the data, he will be convinced. So in other words, Ben Carson was relying on facts. He was relying on the science to convince his opponent. Now, Donald Trump, on the other hand, had a chance to respond. And instead of talking about facts or figures, what he decided to talk about is one incident. So he was telling the story of one of his employees who had a little child, and the child went to get the childhood vaccines and later on became autistic. And so Donald Trump was telling a story, and he was using a lot of details and colors, and he really was using emotion and actually triggering emotion in the people that were listening. And even when I was listening to his story, I myself felt alarmed, you know.
Because you had this eight-week-old baby.
Right. Yeah. I was the target audience. I was the parent of a newborn. And parents of newborns are usually quite stressed. And when we're stressed, that's what I talk about in another chapter of the book, we tend to be hypervigilant to any kind of negative information. And so I was really taking that in. Now, I knew perfectly well about all of these studies because I'm a neuroscientist and I'm also the mother of two young kids. But nevertheless, it had an effect. It had an effect. And, you know, I kind of was second guessing my own decisions. Should I vaccinate my kids? Should I not vaccinate the kid? Of course, finally, I did vaccinate my kids, you know, because in some ways, being aware of what was going on and being aware of why I was reacting the way I was reacting was helpful in finally reaching the decision that I think was right for me.
Yeah.
But it really illustrates, you know, telling a story, triggering emotion has more of an effect than just telling someone, well, these are the facts and, you know, you should just look at the facts and that is a truth.
Do you see in some – we're framing the conversation today kind of around the fact that on Thanksgiving, people are going to be of different minds and families are going to be gathering together, maybe wanting to have arguments, wanting to maybe change the minds of our – as we're saying, you know, our crazy uncle. Do you see the book in some ways as a kind of a manual – for getting someone to change their mind? I mean, no, it's not quite that simple, but do you ever think of it in those terms?
Well, you know, it's not quite a manual, but it can help because what the book is about, it's about how we generate beliefs, how we think, how we make decisions. And if we understand how we do this and what's going on in our mind, well, that means two things. That means that A, we will probably be better able to change other people's minds, right? If you understand the minds of everyone around you to some degree, then you'll be better able at changing those minds. And two, if we understand our own way of thinking, our own processes and why we react the way we do, well, we will be better able to be conscious about why we think what we think, why we make the decision that we make. And so in that sense, it's definitely something that people can use.
Yeah.
So I think my goal is to share the knowledge that we have in our field of psychology and neuroscience and behavioral economics. And the idea is that people can use that knowledge.
So I want to get to this, come back to this question of whether or not facts or data matters all that much in the scheme of things. You tell the story about these scientists who recruited some undergraduates, and they were of two minds on the question of the death penalty. They either were for it or they opposed it. And this study presented them with this evidence, and the question was whether or not they would find these studies convincing. Would they change their minds? Talk a little bit about this experiment and what we learned from it.
Mm-hmm. So this experiment, and there's many others like it on different topics, right? We have a study on climate change. There are studies on gun control. It's always kind of the idea is quite similar, that you have people coming in with a strong position on these questions. And then you give them data. And the data can actually either confirm what they already believe or can go against it. So the example that you gave was on the death penalty. And so half of the participants were given a study showing the advantage of the death penalty, perhaps, economic advantage. And half of them were showing studies of the disadvantage of the death penalty. Again, it could be economic. It could be ethical disadvantages. And they were asked to read the articles and then again, we're asked about their position to see whether these articles and the data change the way that they view, in this case, the death penalty. And what was found is that these articles actually polarized individuals. So it made, if someone was for the death penalty and then they read an article that supported the death penalty, perhaps suggesting that there is an economic advantage, it made them more supportive of the death penalty. However, when they read an article that was against the death penalty, if they were for it, it didn't change their minds much. And sometimes they even saw a boomerang effect. So the boomerang effect is basically when you encounter evidence that goes against what you think. For example, let's say you are for the death penalty and someone says, they are, ethical issues with that. You will then come up with new reasons for why the death penalty is actually something that you support. So it will actually trigger you to rationalize why you should actually support what you're already thinking of. And that is a boomerang effect. When you give people evidence that actually disconfirms what they believe, but they come up with new arguments that they haven't thought about before that actually makes them feel stronger about this issue.
Right.
So participants left the lab actually being more polarized than when they entered.
You know, what's interesting about that for me, and it kind of surprised me, was, as you say, the greater your cognitive ability, the better you are or think you are at analyzing something, the worse you are at being convinced by data, it seems.
Yeah, so this is a great study by Dan Kahan at Yale University. And what he showed is that people who have better math and analytical skills actually have more of this confirmation bias. So what he did, he took 1,000 Americans, and the first thing he did, he gave them some math tests, an analytical test, and based on these tests, he divided them into those with high math skills and those with low math skills. Then he gave everyone two sets of data. One set of data, he said, is looking at whether skin treatment is helping rashes. Please look at the data, analyze the data, and tell us, is it helping or not? Now, no one had a strong opinion about skincare, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So unsurprisingly, people with better math skills did better at analyzing the data. Then he gave them another data set, and this was data set looking at whether gun control laws are reducing crime.
Right. Now, really controversial issue. Big difference.
Yeah, the difference here is that everyone has very strong opinions about gun control laws. And what he found is that this kind of motivation to believe one thing interfered with people's ability to analyze the data. And actually, those with better math skills did worse. Because it seems that they were using their skills not necessarily to find the truth, but to find fault with the data that they were unhappy with.
Yeah. So the lesson takeaway here, I guess, for this part is that bringing all of these articles and data to the Thanksgiving dinner to make your case about gun control is it's not going to work that well, because that's not how our minds are working, or that's not how people's minds are going to be changed.
Yeah, so it's important to make the following point, which is data is very, very important, right? Facts and data are important to find the truth, right? I'm a scientist. This is what I do. Right. I try to find data to figure out what's going on. So I'm not saying that data and figures are not important. They're extremely important. They're also extremely useful in shifting people's minds who already have a similar point of view as you, right? It is when you're trying to convince someone who has a different point of view and they have a motivation to hold to that point of view, that's when things become tricky. And that's where data and facts and figures are not enough. And that's when we need to think about how can we facilitate our ability to get, you know, the other side to listen to what we're saying. And, you know, one thing is, as we said, well, you know, examples, individual examples, stories, eliciting emotion helps in trying to convey the truth.
Yeah.
And also another thing that helps is that if we can find common ground, so even if you disagree with a person sitting across from you in the Thanksgiving dinner, there's probably something that you do agree about, right?
Yeah.
So you have to ask yourself, well, can we actually start with a common belief that we have or a common motivation? And let me give you one example of how that has been actually done. So again, if we go back to the examples of the example of autism and vaccines, there was a study conducted by researchers at UCLA. And they wanted to see how can you convince parents who do not want to vaccinate their kids because of the alleged link, how can you convince them otherwise?
Yeah.
Now, the normal approach of the health professionals is, again, to show the data and say, look, there is a data, there isn't a link. And that doesn't work very well. So instead, they tried another approach. And their kind of thinking was the following. Can we actually focus not on what we disagree on, not focus on the link to autism, but can we actually get to the same outcome, which is get the parents to vaccinate their kids by focusing on something that we agree on?
Mm-hmm.
And so what they focused on was that these vaccines actually protect kids from diseases that could be deadly, right?
Yeah.
Measles, mumps. The parents didn't disagree about this. They had no reason to not believe the doctors when the doctor said the vaccines can protect your kids from these potentially deadly diseases. And so it seemed that that approach, highlighting the benefits of these vaccines, it's something that the parents knew, but it seemed to have been forgotten in the heated debate. That had a much better outcome. It changed parents' intentions of vaccinating their kids 3 times as much than the normal approach.
Wow. Tali Sherratt, she's a cognitive neuroscientist and an associate professor at University College London. We're talking about her new book. It's called The Influential Mind, What the Brain Reveals About Our Power to Change Others. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking with the neuroscientist Tali Sherratt about why it's so difficult to change someone's mind. She has a new book. It's called The Influential Mind, What the Brain Reveals About Our Power to Change Others. Let's talk about you write about the getting inside the mind of an audience. There's a story you tell of this incredibly great speech delivered by President John F. Kennedy. This was in 1962. Of course, he's talking about whether or not we should go to the moon as a country, the United States. And he had to convince American citizens. And he delivers this extraordinary speech. And there are a lot of lessons here about what's going on inside the mind of an audience. Let's talk about that. Talk about this speech.
Mm-hmm. So I gave an example of his speech as well as a speech from, you know, Susan Cain when I was listening to her at TED. And you can give many, many examples. The point that I'm trying to make is that these speeches that really capture people's mind a lot of time trigger emotion. And emotion has seemed to gotten a bad rep. But in fact, emotion is very, very important. What emotion does, it conveys information.
Mm-hmm.
Right. The reason that emotion can be transferred quickly and easily from one person to the other is because it conveys some important information about the environment. So, for example, if I see someone in front of me and they look like they're afraid, then my immediate reaction is to be afraid too. And this is a good thing. It's adaptive because if I'm afraid, I'm going to start to scan my environment for potential danger, right? Because if he's afraid, there might be something around that puts both of us in danger, and that will help me survive. Or if the person that is in front of me seems excited, then automatically, because of emotion contagion, I will feel excited as well. And again, this is adaptive because this feeling of excitement will cause me to look around the environment for potential rewards, right? And if he's excited, there's probably some rewards around, and I should be searching for them as well. So the point that I'm trying to make is that emotion is a genius process that evolution came up with to convey information from one person or even one animal to another animal. When something emotional happens or we see something emotional happening, it captures our attention.
Yeah.
So we're more likely to look at that. We're more likely to listen to what is said if it's emotional. We're more likely to remember it. So there's a lot of research, and actually this my own PhD many years ago was about this, on how emotion enhances our memory. So when we feel emotion, the amygdala, which is part of the brain that is important for emotional processing, it's a small part deep in the brain. We have two on each side. It's about the size of a cherry tomato. It's activated. And the amygdala sits right next to another part of the brain called the hippocampus. Mm-hmm. The hippocampus is important for memory. And so when emotion is triggered, it actually changes the function of the hippocampus, and it makes us more likely to remember as well. So this is why when someone is giving a speech, whether, you know, it's the Kennedy speech or any other speech, if they are able to trigger emotion in their audience, they will capture attention. They will enhance memory. They will also be it'll be easier for them to convey their goal, the aim, what they feel. Because if someone is in the same emotional state as you, they will process the information that you're conveying in a similar manner to how you are processing it as well.
Emotion is extremely contagious, you write about. And it seems like there's this, it's not quite a hive mind going on, but there's this kind of synchronization going on in audiences. What are we doing? We're transferring emotion amongst ourselves? Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I think one of the I give this example of a study. It's one of my favorite. And this is a study that was conducted at the University of California, San Francisco, where they wanted to see how parents' emotions affect their infants' emotions. And in doing so, actually conveying information to the infants. So what they did is they brought in caregivers with their infants, and then they separated them. So the infants went into one room, and there were some researchers playing with them, while the caregivers went to another room. And some of the caregivers were put in a very stressful situation. They had to give a speech in front of an audience. And some of the caregivers were put in a relaxed situation. And then they had them reunited with their infants. And what they found is when the parent that was stressed was holding the infant, that infant became stressed as well. Their heart rate started going up to synchronize with the heart rate of the caregiver. They maybe started sweating while the infant that was held by a relaxed parent was relaxed. Now, so for this only tells us, well, if you're in one state, in one emotional state, you can affect another person's emotional state without even saying a word. But here's an even more interesting thing. The infant that was held by the stressed parent was then less likely to interact with the people around them. In other words, what happened was that the information that was unconsciously conveyed to the infant is the environment is not safe, right?
Yeah.
The stress reaction caused the infant unconsciously to get the message that the environment wasn't safe and they shouldn't be interacting with the people around them. And that's, I think, just a great example of how, again, from these effective responses, we convey important information about the environment.
You write about how it is we go about motivating people. different organizations, you know, amongst ourselves, and whether or not it works to scare someone into a certain kind of action or behavior. And there's this study, I think this was from 2008, people in the New York State hospital system, they were trying to get their employees to wash their hands, basically. But it provided, I think, an important lesson in terms of motivation. Talk about this, if you would.
Yeah. So often we kind of think, what way is best to motivate people, whether it's our employees or our kids? And often we either give carrots or we give sticks, right? We either warn people of possible bad things in the future, punishments, or we offer them rewards. If you do this, you'll get this great reward. And the question is, when do we use one? When would you use the other?
Yeah.
In most states, in most environments, actually, it turns out that rewards are more effective. So let me give you this example that you just mentioned. So in a hospital in New York State, they wanted to get the medical staff to wash their hands more often, right? Because that's really important for preventing the spread of disease. Now, the first thing that they did, they simply put cameras on top of every door to just see how often medical staff wash their hands before and aftering a patient's room. And there were actually people in India watching these individuals in real time. And what they found is that although the medical staff knew that the cameras were installed, it wasn't a nanny camera situation, only 1 in 10 medical staff sanitized their hands before and after entering a patient's room.
Yeah.
So that means, you know, just observation is not enough.
Right.
So then they added another kind of manipulation, which is they put an electronic board above the doors. And every time people actually sanitized their hands, there was positive feedback immediately going up on the electronic board saying, you know, well done, good shift, as well as they could see the numbers, the rate of the current shift rate and the weekly rate go up, right? So they can see their numbers going up. And compliance raised to almost 90% and stayed there. So from 10%, it raised to 90% of medical staff are now washing their hands before and after entering a patient's room. So it's such a huge effect that the scientists were a bit skeptic. So they made sure to replicate it in another division in the hospital. And again, they found exactly the same effect. And so the question is, why does this work?
Yeah.
And the answer is quite general. It's not just about hand washing. And I think the reason that it works is that instead of using the normal approach, so what would be the normal approach? The normal approach would be to warn medical staff of bad things in the future, right? Warn them, if you don't wash their hands, you will spread the disease. And it turns out that doesn't really work very well because people kind of say, well, it's going to be fine. You know, they disregard it.
Yeah.
Instead of that, they used immediate rewards. And immediate rewards, studies show, are very effective at changing behaviors. There are a few reasons for that. But I think, you know, what we need to consider here is both the word immediate and the word reward.
Yeah.
So the first thing that we know is that immediate rewards, so immediate positive feedback or even if it's monetary reward, if it's immediate, it has much more of an effect than if you give it at a later time. And there's two reasons for that. One reason is what we call the attribution problem. So imagine that your partner is washing the dishes and you give them a kiss. So it's clear that your kiss is related to washing the dishes. And so they're more likely to wash the dishes again in the future. Now, imagine now that your partner is washing the dishes, but you give them a kiss the next day. Okay. Now it's not so clear that the kiss is related to washing the dishes and they're less likely to repeat that action. So that's one reason why when things are immediate, they are more likely to enhance the action, right? The second reason is what we call temporal discounting. So temporal discounting is basically the fact that people would rather get rewards now than in the future because they value things now more. Mm-hmm. When you ask people, would you rather get $100 now or would you rather get $110 next week? Most people say, I want to get $100 now. And one of the reasons is that $100 now is something certain, right? It's in your pocket. $110 next week, well, you know, we never know what's going to happen. And so immediacy really, really matters. The other thing that matters, as I said before, is rewards. So this, what we find is that to elicit action, to get people to do something, rewards are more effective than punishment.
Yeah.
And the reason is that in life, to get the good stuff, whether it's a chocolate cake or love or a promotion, we usually need to act. We usually need to do something, right? So our brain has adapted to that kind of environment. To get the good stuff, we need to move. We need to do something. And so the reward circuit in our brain is connected to the motor circuit in our brain. And we expect, when we expect something good, what we call a go signal is activated and we're more likely to act. Okay, so if you want someone to do something, offering rewards is a good way to go. However, if you want someone not to do something, punishments are actually more effective. So the reason is that in life, to avoid the bad stuff, whether it's poison or deep waters or untrustworthy people, we usually need to just not do anything, just to stay away. Not always, but often, to avoid bad stuff, we need to not act. And so our brain has adapted to that kind of environment. And when we anticipate something bad, there's a no-go signal in our brain, and it makes us less likely to act. So this is why, if you think about it, the medical staff, when you told them, well, if you don't wash your hands, you will spread disease, that didn't work as well as when they know that if they wash their hands, they get an immediate positive feedback. Hmm. Positive feedback actually elicits a reward signal in our brain. And so it reinforces the action that causes it. And just one thing to kind of say is that we need to remember that all of these kind of behavioral rules that I'm talking about, psychology and even, you know, neuroscience, it's not like physics, right? There's not one rule like gravity that always works in most environments. Behavior is kind of, it's complex, and it changes from context to context. And, you know, there are individual differences, and it also changes according to the mental state that the person is already in. So it's not enough, it's not something that's always going to work. We do need to take into account all these other factors. One thing that we find is that when people are under stress, actually, warning them is more useful than if you try to warn someone who's relaxed.
Let's talk about control. This is an important theme in the book, in a section. And you compare at this part of the book the 10 leading causes of death with the 10 most common phobias. And you would think they would relate, that we would know what the leading causes of death are, and therefore would be the things we are afraid of. But they don't match up really at all. And this seems to tell us something. I think this is about, I guess it's about control. Talk a little bit about this.
Yeah, so we're very bad at knowing what we should fear and knowing what we shouldn't fear. And so one example that I give is that a lot of people are afraid of flying. It really is, you know, an uncomfortable feeling for many people to be on a plane. And you may say, well, it's because we fear, you know, going down. And that could be a partial reason. But really, one of the main reasons that people are so anxious and feel so negative when they're on a plane is because we have no control, right? When we get on a plane, we have no control of what's going on. And we don't really know what's going on, right? Most of the time, we don't know exactly where we are, what, you know, if turbulence is something that we should be concerned or shouldn't be concerned. We can't even choose. We don't have much choices about what we're going to eat, or, you know. So we really feel this kind of control that's been taken away from us. And that's something that people really hate.
Yeah.
Our brain treats control as a reward in and of itself. And we treat the lack of control as something aversive.
Yeah.
And so anytime there's a lack of control, we become anxious. And so a lot of these things that we fear, whether it is, you know, flying, or whether it is, what else do we fear? Oh, Kyle, yeah, animals, you know, all kinds of spiders or whatever, is things that don't actually hold, you know, a likelihood that will actually cause us harm. And a lot of the things that we don't fear can actually cause us harm. So driving, we don't fear driving so much when we get into the car and we drive because we feel in control, you know.
Yeah.
But driving actually can be quite a dangerous thing, medicating ourselves. People don't fear medicating themselves. Again, this is one of the leading causes that can cause us harm. So whether something is under control or not under control, that is an important factor.
Yeah, and people who feel in control, you write, of their lives, for example, they're happier and they're healthier. This experiment you write about, where these two researchers, I think this was in the 1970s, were working with elderly people in nursing homes to basically, I guess they were testing what happens when you give these people more control or even a perception of having more control over their destiny. It has an effect on their it seems like their well-being and their physical well-being.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, if we feel one of the reasons that control has a positive effect on our health and well-being is that when we feel in control, we feel we can steer the wheel in the right direction, mm-hmm. right? And so the future is brighter. If we feel we're not in control, well, we don't know what's going to happen. We're not necessarily will go in the right direction if we can't control what's going on. And so control, interestingly enough, is related to optimism. And, you know, optimism is my other book, The Optimism Bias.
Yeah.
People who believe they have more control are also more optimistic. And being optimistic, believing that your future is bright, reduces stress and anxiety, and that in and of itself has positive effects on our physical and mental health.
That's Tali Sherratt. Her new book is The Influential Mind: What the Brain Reveals About Our Power to Change Others. We'll take another break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUE. It's Doug Fabrizio. Let me play something for you real quick.
When I looked at myself in the mirror, I saw someone no good Mormon girl would ever marry. I saw someone who was losing the battle with Satan.
It's a man who recorded himself in his Mormon ward. KUER's Lee Hale found that tape, and you can hear our conversation about pornography in the Mormon Church on our new podcast, More to Say, wherever you get your podcasts. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now to our conversation with Tali Sherratt. We're talking about her new book, The Influential Mind. One of your chapters is about the value and the burden of knowledge. And you begin by observing how many of us actually pay attention to these pre-flight safety demonstrations when we're on a flight. Talk a little bit about that. Like, what is the information we want to know, because the airline is trying to get us to pay attention, but often we don't want to, and I think it's interesting why.
Yeah. So there are different reasons why in this case. Well, one of the reasons is, well, we probably feel we know the information, right? We're like, oh, we've heard it 100 million times before. But in fact, if you quiz people about where exactly is the closest exit, or even like where is their safety vest, we usually don't know, right? So we have this feeling that we've heard it, but because we've never actually listened, we don't know. And in fact, every plane is different, so that we don't have the information that we need. Second, we might feel, well, it's not important. You know, why do we need to know this? And as we said, okay, yes, the likelihood of something negative happening is low. But in fact, if it does happen, being able to act fast is quite important, right? And so if you go over information recently, you know, just before you fly, then you're more likely to act fast and know where the exit is and so on. Now, the third reason, which I find most interesting, is we don't want to think about the bad stuff,
yeah.
right? So listening to the pre-flight safety information elicits these negative feelings of bad things might happen. And this is something that we'd rather avoid. So instead, we engage our mind in, you know, looking at our smartphones, whether it's the new Facebook or whatever. And that is something that we see, of course, in other situations. So people have a tendency to want to know. We do have a tendency to want information and we want knowledge, but less so when the information is something that may be bad news. And this is why, for example, a lot of people do not go to medical screenings. A lot of people avoid medical screenings because they're trying to avoid the fear and the negative feelings of bad news, even if those medical screenings at the end can save us.
You say reframe the message so the information you provide induces hope, not dread. Seems like the takeaway there.
Yeah. So because people are more likely to pay attention and remember and search for good information, we need to reframe our message to show people how this information can actually help them. And in fact, anything that we have to say usually does have, you know, we're trying to actually get people to do better. And so let me give you a few examples. So I have students, and let's say my student did a really bad job on a paper. And so one thing I can do is I can say, oh, this is terrible, you know, and if you don't do a better job next time, you're going to fail. So what I can do is highlight the negative consequences. The other thing I can do is say, well, these are all the problems with the paper, but this is what you can do to improve next time. So it's not that I'm sugarcoating what I have to say, right? I'm presenting the problem clearly, but I'm reframing it in a way of what can you do to get better in the future, to get a better grade in the future, rather than trying to induce anxiety and fear of the negative consequences. Or, for example, you know, if my daughter wants to go out in the cold without a coat, I might say, well, if you don't put the coat on, you will be ill. So highlight the negative. Instead, I could say, well, if you put the coat on, you'll be cozy and warm and healthy and in great shape to go to your birthday party this weekend.
Right.
So it's the same thing, but I'm just highlighting what has to be done in order to get to the positive consequence rather than the negative consequence.
Well, I wanted to ask you about what happens to our minds when they're under threat. And you tell this really interesting, kind of strange story from 3 days after 9/11. This is in 2001. This is on the streets of New York City. And there's this thing that happens. It's kind of a phenomenon. I wanted you to tell the story and talk about it, if you would.
I think a lot of people can relate to this. So when something bad happens, where we're under stress, and this could be a public event, such as a terrorist attack, people tend to get stressed, even if the attack is halfway across the world. And when people get stressed, they start becoming hypervigilant to any kind of negative possible information around them. So I gave this example. So I was in Manhattan on 9/11. I was living in New York. I was doing my PhD at the time. And a few days later, we were walking down the street, and suddenly we saw a few people start running away. And so we started running as well. I think it started with one person, and then a few joined, and then we joined as well. And at the end, it was this very, very large group of people running down the street, and people kept, like, you know, joining and running down, and no one knew what was going on. And in fact, nothing was going on. Turns out that just one person started running for whatever reason, and then people started joining. Now, if it wasn't a few days after 9/11, if it was a few days before 9/11, I'm pretty sure that most people would not have joined in. He would probably be running down the street on his own. You know, we're kind of used to people exhibiting odd behaviors, especially
in New York City, right?
Yeah, so it's not something unusual. But of course, in that situation, everyone was very much under kind of high stress, very much so, and hypervigilant to anything negative. And so our reactions were kind of enhanced in that way. But what the story comes to show is that under different mental states, such as under stress, it really changes the way that our brain functions and it changes the way that we process information. We showed the same kind of thing in the lab. So what we did is we wanted to put people under stress. And the way that we did it is we brought people into the lab, and these were undergraduate students, and we told them, okay, we're going to give you a surprise topic, and you're going to have to give a speech about the surprise topic for 5 minutes in front of everyone else, and we're going to judge you, and we're going to videotape you, and we're going to put it on YouTube. And so the students found that quite stressful. They said it was stressful. We actually checked their cortisol levels in the saliva, which is an indication of stress. It went up. And we also checked how much they were sweating, their what's called the skin conductance response, and that went up as well. So they were definitely stressed. And then we gave them a task, a little experiment, where we gave them a lot of kind of negative information and positive information about the rate of disease and rate of violent acts. And we found that under stress, people immediately became better at processing the negative information. They were more likely to kind of process it and to update their beliefs according to the negative information that we gave them. And it really happened within seconds. So there is a great change in how your mind works and how you process information when you're under stress or when you're relaxed. And you think about it, it's quite adaptive, right?
Yeah.
Because if there's danger in an environment that you get stressed, you should probably kind of be more attuned to what's going on around you. But of course, I think we overreact sometimes. It's hard to, you know, it's hard to know when we should and shouldn't be stressed. And so you could see these suboptimal behaviors, such as, for example, after terrorist attacks, people decide to cancel their flights and drive instead, where driving is more dangerous than flying. Or after stock market collapse, people get stressed and they start selling their stocks when actually at that time they should hold on.
Yeah. There's a section in the book where you consider what you call the future of influence, what influence is going to look like in the future. And, you know, you ask whether or not we're going to be able to, I guess, physically connect our brains directly to influence people, which sounds kind of creepy and dystopian in some ways. And you say we're a long way off from this, but there are some scientists who are like there are these scientists at Duke University who are experimenting to see if they can transmit messages, in this case, pretty simple messages, between the brains of mice. Talk a little bit about this, too.
Mm-hmm. So the reason I have that chapter is to make the point that what influence really is, it is activity in one brain affecting the activity in another brain.
Yeah.
The way that we usually do this is by words. There's kind of a neural reaction in my brain, and that causes me to say something, and that those words travel through space, and the sound reaches your ears, and that, you know, eventually causes a neural response in your brain, and it can change your beliefs or your behavior. And so the idea is, well, this could happen without the need for speech, or without the need for me to write something, right? Mm-hmm. Without the need to see something, you could just take that neural response from my brain and transmit it directly to yours, right? Yeah. So theoretically, that should be possible. Of course, in order to actually do that, we need to really know a lot about the human brain, you know, and be able to map a lot of the things. And of course, we don't. But at the moment, it doesn't mean that it's not possible sometime in the future. But for now, what has been shown is just the principle, right? That the principle could work. So there are different studies in mice, studies in human. But I could tell you about the study that you mentioned, which is also described in the book, where they had two mice, and one was learning about how to get rewards. So, for example, when they saw a red light, they knew they had to press the right lever, and if they did that, they get, you know, a little bit of food. If they saw the yellow light, they had to press the left lever, and then they would get the food. The other mouse didn't see any of the lights, so they had no indication of what they should be doing. But what they did get, they get the response from the other mouse's brain. So the first mouse, I call him, you know, the Einstein. He's a teacher. So what they did is they recorded the activity of that mouse's brain, and they transformed that activity directly into the other mouse's brain. And the way that they did that is simply using electrodes. So there's one electrode recording the activity that goes into a computer that does a little bit of processing, and then that activity is transmitted directly to the other brain using an electrode. And so at the beginning, the mouse that has to learn, that he doesn't really know what's going on. It's just like you know, there's some kind of electric trigger in their brain. They don't know what they mean. But after a while, they figure it out. They figure it out that a certain response in the brain means I need to press the right lever, and a certain response means I need to press the left lever, and that's how they get the reward. So the information is transmitted not via one animal watching the other animal, but by activity directly being transformed from one to the other. I think it's interesting. It's a nice demonstration, but I think it's an important demonstration just because I don't believe that people who are not neuroscientists think about this way, right?
Yeah.
We don't really think about influence and communication in this kind of way. So it's a nice demonstration that really highlights this fact.
Well, it comes down to, you say, even though we're not, whether we'll ever get to the point where we're altering a person's brain activity to influence them, you know, physically, we are all of the time altering it with language, right, and expressions and action. And it seems like that's the theme of the book.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. And even if we don't, mean to change someone's reactions, you do. Just being, you know, near an individual, you're gonna alter the other person's brain activity. So definitely if you're saying something, that definitely changes the activity in their brain. If you are just feeling something, even if it's a stranger sitting across from you on the subway, your facial expressions would then affect their brain activity and probably affect how they feel. So even if we want to, we are affecting the people around us. And I think one of the points of the book is, well, you're already influencing other people.
Yeah.
We should know how that happens in order to do it in a way that would have more positive outcomes rather than just be random.
It's Tali Sherratt. Her new book is The Influential Mind, What the Brain Reveals About Our Power to Change Others. She joined us from a studio at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology in Boston. Radio West is a production of KUER News. We had technical direction from Michael Havey. Our thanks to Anthony Scoma. The program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.